Typically, when government agencies hire a contractor to build a bridge or a road, the contractor understands that they just won't be paid unless the project is successful and completed to expectations. Carrie Nakamura of the Sorensen Impact Center says, why can't we do the same for social services working in criminal justice?
And so it's really taking that thinking and putting it into the delivery of services for our most vulnerable citizens. To say, shouldn't we at least do that same thing? Shouldn't we demand that this is the outcome we want for those people? We do not want them cycling back in through the system. We do not want the jail to be the state's largest mental health service hospital or provider. We actually want to do things differently for these people.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a discussion about shifting fundamentally how government funds its substance abuse and mental health programs with the goal of criminal justice reform. But first, here's this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. This week, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted a discussion about criminal justice reform at the local level for Salt Lake County. Last year, the county opted to extend a tax used to build the Salt Lake County Jail for making changes to the county's criminal justice system. They decided to fund two pay-for-success programs, one to address homelessness and the other dealing with recidivism, that is, people cycling in and out of jail. The programs will involve a partnership of corporate funders, philanthropic nonprofits, local service providers, and academics. Mayor Ben McAdams says if the new pay-for-success programs, which promise to employ data-driven and evidence-based practices to meet the county's goals, are successful, the county will repay investors from future collections of the extended jail tax. And if the programs are not successful, such as the number of recidivating offenders does not decrease in time, the county ultimately does not have to pay, thereby removing the cost risk to taxpayers for trying some new approaches to fix the current system. This week, two Salt Lake County Council members, at-large Seat A Councilwoman Jenny Wilson and Amy Winder Newton of District 3, joined Carrie Nakamura, the Government Policy Director of the University of Utah's Sorensen Impact Center. Together, they spoke about the pay-for-success programs the county is initiating with the goal of prison reform. Speaking first here is Jenny Wilson.
So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my role in this, just to give it some context. So I'm a member of the Salt Lake County Council. There are nine of us. Councilmember Bradley and I serve at large. Population of the county is over a million residents. And our budget in total, which includes some pass-through dollars, exceeds $1 billion. So it's a big budget. Our general fund is over $300 million. And a large percentage of our budget goes towards jail management and towards criminal justice initiatives. So it's a we approach criminal justice reform at the county, not just because it's the right thing to do, but it's also a very big percentage, up to even 40% of our citizens' tax dollars. So it's important we get it right. And getting it right is a challenge. It's a challenge for a lot of reasons. You all are too young. There are a few people here who remember the Andy Griffith Show back in the day where Sheriff Andy Griffith went in and he added sidekick Barney, and there was the local jail, and the guy, some guy would steal a candy bar or something, and there'd be a big episode around the candy bar being stolen, and a lot of humor and a lot of fun. Well, when you're dealing with a population, state population of over 3 million people, county population over 1, this can get very complicated. You also look at the role the federal government has with policy. You look at the state and its initiatives and reforms. We do know that most people are in our jail, our county jail, due to substance abuse and mental illness. And all of a sudden that brings in the conversation of, well, what do we do if we can have an intervention earlier? And how expensive is that? And what does it take to get that person on a healthier path? And for our audio, I'll mention that Council Member Newton has joined us, and we'll be speaking shortly. So in any event, we are at Salt Lake County as we run the jail. I think across party lines and with everyone involved, we believe that the days of throw away the keys, lock them up, are long past. We believe that for some time. But the question is, how do you do it efficiently? And you take a tragedy that we all see in our community every day. there isn't a person in this room that doesn't know someone who's suffering from substance abuse or mental illness. I know that's true. So these are our citizens. These are our friends. These are our neighbors. These are our parents. These are our children. We have to figure out a mechanism not just to do it in a way that makes sense, but to be compassionate and ultimately to save the taxpayer, their funding so we can put it to parks and recreation and other things that our county does and other local governments, state, federal government, are intended to do well. So that's the dilemma. How do we do that? And the players at the table, as I mentioned earlier, include federal government, state government, local government. When we have, let's just follow one case, for example. If you have a young person, college age, say, who ends up becoming addicted and the addiction takes over, sooner or later, they're hopefully going to get better or they're going to get worse. If they get worse, they're likely to engage in some level, many of them, of criminal behavior. So what do we do? A nuisance crime, or does this become, as we've seen with substance abuse, often, it's not uncommon now. It's regular news to turn on and see, the Zions Bank on Foothill's been robbed, usually with someone, with a drug addiction. So if you look at the complexity of that case, what do we do? If we were to chase down that criminal who's addicted and we were able to apprehend him or her at Salt Lake City, they're going to have different sentencing laws when the courts kind of roll out versus another jurisdiction. Though ultimately that person may end up for that type of events to be in the Salt Lake County Jail. Are we getting them better? How do we get to the point? How do we get them into programs or into systems that will make, that we're certain that, or we have some hope that they won't commit the crime again, and it becomes a revolving door. I was shocked that about a half year or so ago, I was at a session where one of our downtown providers, a nonprofit organization, who dealt with people who were mentally ill and that are often abusing substance, they tracked one case, and if you look at all of the cost to society in true dollars, the figure they put up on the board was over $800,000. And that included the treatment over 3 or 4 years for programs. It included time in the jail. It included health care and very basic, attention to health needs. The cost of a police officer intervening time and time again. The cost of the prosecutors and all of the elements. So that's what we're facing. And I think we are working at Salt Lake County on initiatives and methods to make this make sense. And a little on Carrie, and she'll talk about her own background a little bit more, but she was the staff to Councilmember Bradley, who's one of my Democratic colleagues, and he's been at the county for quite some time, previously as a commissioner and as a council member. And they had, of the nine of us, I think a unique interest in these policy issues. And Carrie really invested herself with Councilmember Bradley in the statistics, in the need, in defining the next level of what I've just described, and did a great job for us. And then she now has an opportunity at the university to look into this. So further, evidence-based practices, we're now having more conversations about data, measuring data, and that's really the forum we're going to present to you today, is what role does data have in this equation of, the shared goals of getting an individual healthier, working that so that they do not commit crimes, and assuring that if they are unfortunate enough to end up some time in our Salt Lake County Jail, that they don't come back. So with that, I'm going to turn the time over to Councilmember Winder Newton, who can kind of elaborate a little more on some of the work we're doing.
Well, thank you. So as Jenny mentioned, we've got our number one budget priority, which is criminal justice reform, and that's just because the jail takes up so much of our budget. With 600 people a month that we're sending out onto the streets because we just don't have room, this is a huge issue for us. And so, it's funny in government, and as an elected official, we oftentimes get programs brought to us and we go, oh, this is a great idea. This would be so good. It would help people. but we don't really know for sure. And so we go ahead and sometimes fund these things, and people go out and do their thing, and we never really know if it worked or if it didn't work. And we just think maybe, oh, it sounds like a good program, and we think it's going to work, and we think it's going to make an impact, and we hear a few success stories, and we pat ourselves on the back and say, yay, we did something good. And one of the things that we're realizing is we can't afford to work that way anymore, because it is so expensive to pay for a secure facility to lock people up. And we're obviously, we don't have enough room to lock everybody up who may need lockup. And so we have to look at new ways to do things. And so that's kind of what we've started doing. We recently went through a process. So this last budget session, which was in December, the council decided that we were going to extend a tax. The jail bond from 20 years ago was falling off at the end of the year. We decided we were going to extend that tax and put it into criminal justice reform. And we didn't quite know how that was going to look. We didn't know what that was going to look like yet. But we knew we had to do something. We knew there was lots of unfunded needs and lots of problems that we needed to address. And so we wanted to take the first stab at doing that. And so Jenny and I put together a retreat that where we got the sheriff and DA and our behavioral health specialists and the council and the mayor's office and everybody around the table for 2 days. And we really talked about criminal justice reform and what the needs were. Now, one of our issues, and this was interesting, it's always, as a council member, it's always nice when everybody comes to you and says, we need money for this, and all of us represent this area, and we are unanimously in favor of funding it this way. And that didn't happen for us. We had some varying viewpoints on how to spend those criminal justice funds. We had the mayor who was wanting to be very proactive in looking at some evidence-based practices and doing some good, using data to make some decisions. But then we had our criminal justice experts, behavioral health, the sheriff, the DA, who were going, we're hemorrhaging. We need money for this, this, and this, and this is just a problem with funding. And so one of the things that we found ourselves in was this quandary of, well, who do we listen to? Because we don't want to ignore our criminal justice experts, but we know that there's something here that the mayor's talking about that makes sense, too, that we need to be looking ahead on. And so needless to say, it put us in kind of an awkward position, and we were able to define how we wanted to spend this $9.4 million and kind of make both sides a little bit happy. So we decided to do these two pay-for-success programs, one for those who are in the criminal justice system but have a homeless issue. And so we're finding a lot of people are cycling in and out of our jail and using it basically as a homeless shelter. They're getting picked up for different crimes that are related to their homelessness problems. And so that's one of our pay-for-success programs. And then the other one is on recidivism. We're finding a high number of people who are cycling in and out. And we want to get to the bottom of that and find out, well, why? What is not working in some of these programs that we have been doing? And so those are two of the things that we funded. But we also have a little bit of money that we wanted to help stop the hemorrhaging with. And so we're actually going to be hearing tomorrow from our behavioral health and our sheriff on some programs probably that will include detox beds, funding for mental health and substance abuse right off the bat, and some things that can kind of help us as we move along. To kind of talk a little bit about the Pay for Success program, how many of you have ever heard of Pay for Success? Raise your hand if you have. Okay, a few of you have. So basically, this is a funding mechanism, if you will, that takes a problem and we identify what we want the outcome to be right off the bat. So if the outcome is we want fewer people to recidivate and cycle in and out of jail, that's the outcome that we want, and here's the percentage of people that we want to see decrease with that recidivism issue. Well, then we go through a process where we define what the measurables will look like. We have a separate third party, which in this case is the University of Utah, who will look at those and be able to say, yes, you met the outcomes. The outcomes were met, and the program was successful. They'll basically tell us if it was successful or not. And then we have nonprofit groups and other groups that will actually do the program and make it happen. And then we have financial people who have come in, Goldman Sachs or other people have come in and said, we will pay for this up front, we'll pay for this program, knowing that if it works and if your outcomes happen, we will get paid back with interest, and that's when the county will pay. And so as an elected official, I love this concept because to not have to pay for a program that doesn't work is very appealing to me. We want to pay for what works. And so if this is structured properly, it's a great system because then government's only paying when outcomes are met and there's evidence and data to prove it, and then we're willing to say, yeah, here's your money, and that does work. And so those are what these pay-for-success programs are doing, and I probably didn't explain it nearly as well as Carrie will, because she's the expert on this, and that's why we wanted her to come too and kind of be able to talk a little bit more about it. But as an elected official, being able to know that the money, because we're spending your hard-earned tax dollars, and we want to make sure that what we're spending it on is making a difference in the community. Not just that we think it is, but that it really is, and we're able to measure that.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today we're broadcasting a discussion recorded this week about a pay-for-success approach to criminal justice reform that Salt Lake County is initiating. Speaking just now was Councilwoman Amy Winder Newton of District 3, and before her, at-large seat A Councilwoman Jenny Wilson. After the break, we'll hear from Carrie Nakamura, the Government Policy Director of the University of Utah's Sorenson Impact Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, we are airing a panel discussion held earlier this week about an innovative approach that Salt Lake County is about to undertake to reform its criminal justice system. The panelists include council members Jenny Wilson and Amy Winder Newton, and Government Policy Director of the University of Utah's Sorenson Impact Center, Carrie Nakamura. This is Carrie.
About a year ago, I did make the switch up to the University of Utah, and it was a very emotional decision to leave Councilman Bradley after a decade in county government working on issues that I care deeply about. But when I told him what the opportunity was, he said, "You have to go. This is exactly the kind of thing that you love and what you've worked your career for, and it's an opportunity to start a new center and a new program." So I want to start by giving you just a little bit of a background on the Sorenson Impact Center. The mission of the center is to accelerate positive and sustainable social change on a national and global scale by leveraging private capital for social good. And there was something really appealing to me about that. To be able to go in and where I could see that there were so many needs in a community and so many services where we needed to rethink the way we were doing things, to be able to maybe leverage another way to do that was incredibly appealing. And let me tell you a little bit why. My background is I've been in government for about 25 years. You will never find my name on a ballot. These two are far braver than I am. I will not put my name on a ballot.
Never say never.
but what my passion is, my passion really is good government. And I know that sounds cliche, and I know people say, you know, that's kind of silly. Why do you say that? But I've spent my career in largely budget and in the budget office. And one of the things that I know about a public budget is that if I look at a public budget, I can clearly see what the values of that community and the leadership of that community are just by looking at those numbers, because budget and policy are so connected and so locked. And one of the things that I've really been passionate about is outcomes-based budgeting. And as Councilmember Newton talked about, that was what really appealed to me about what was going on at the Sorenson Impact Center at the University of Utah. And at its core, if I came in and told you that I was going to talk to you about governmental procurement reform, most of you would probably nod off and not want to listen for very long. But really, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about fundamentally shifting the way government thinks about purchasing services, and especially within the social service arena. We all know that in the medical field, you go out and you have randomized control trials and you do lots of data and investigation of different kinds of interventions for different kinds of health problems that people have. But when we talk about substance abuse and we talk about mental health, we don't do that. That has not been the norm in our country for how we provide interventions. And we have the benefit here at the University of Utah and in Salt Lake County of having the Utah Criminal Justice Center through the School of Social Work here on campus. We have research academics that have been researching these types of interventions, the different mental health interventions, substance abuse interventions, homelessness interventions, and trying to determine for which people will different interventions work appropriately. And the idea that they maybe could short track their research, their academic research, and get it into the hands of policymakers so that policymakers can start talking about outcomes, and that we really want to stop that revolving door at the jail, we really want to stop cycles of recidivism, was pretty attractive and powerful to me. And it really does focus back on that outcomes-based budgeting. So I want to take a detour for just a quick minute and give you a really quick tutorial on outcomes-based budgeting in America, because it's kind of an interesting history. In about 1870, the first federal outcomes-based budgeting or budget reform act was passed, and it was passed by the federal government because of abuses in local governments. So it was kind of interesting that they were using a federal tool to try to get local governments to budget better. And then over the years, in the 1950s, a Budget Accounting and Procedures Act was passed at the federal level. And usually what happens in these is the federal government will pass it, and then state and local governments maybe lag just a little bit behind, but then start to adopt the same kinds of reforms. In the 1990s, the federal government performance data that was starting to be collected from this act in the 50s finally went public. Prior to that, it was internal data that the federal government used but didn't share with the public to talk about the success of any federal programs. In 1993, the Government Performance and Results Act was adopted and implemented, and it said that you had to have performance measures and progress reports surrounding those measures as part of the budget process. What a novel concept, huh? That we would actually report on what we're doing in our budgets. From 1996 to 2000, all federal agencies were mandated to use outcomes-based performance measures as part of their budgeting process. In 2002, the federal OMB developed and integrated performance measurement, but not performance budgeting per se, as part of their performance reporting tool, the directive that they gave out. In 2010, the OMB issued 128 high-priority performance goals for the federal government. And then what I think is one of the most exciting things is that in 2012, New York City issued the first social impact bond in America in the issue area of recidivism reduction. And the reason that I give you that history behind outcomes-based budgeting in America and then the excitement of 2010 for me is that because as somebody who's been working with governments, and I've consulted with council members, I've consulted with mayors, I've consulted with governors, and I even consulted with one president, a very small nation, but it was a president nonetheless, on outcomes-based budgeting, the difficulty is that everybody always talks about outcomes-based and we're going to look at outcomes and we're not just going to focus on outputs and inputs, outputs, efficiency measures. We're going to focus on outcomes, but then we never really do. People come to these fine elected officials and pitch a program, and if somebody's persuasive, the program gets funded. And we never really step back and say, is it achieving its goal? Is it doing what we wanted it to do? We do a lot of reporting on outputs. Government has a lot of data available to it. For example, in a job training program, this is how a budget conversation over the years might go. We have a service provider in the community that's doing job training, and they come in to the elected officials and say, you know, I am providing job training services for 50 people a month, and we really think that what we're doing is great, and we have a couple cases here where we can show you people did great stuff based on the services we provide and would like to provide services for 60 people a month. And the elected officials say, wow, you know, we have a lot of budget requests and we don't think we can go that high. Maybe can we go to 55? Does that work for you? You can do 55. Yep, and we'll get them through quicker and we'll get them through our program quicker. What's wrong with that conversation? Nobody ever stepped back and said, at the end of the job training program, are people having jobs that diminish their reliance on other parts of the system? Do they have a job at 3 months out, 6 months out, 9 months out, 12 months out? Are they, do they have those jobs? Are they no longer having to take public assistance? Are they able to provide for their family in a more sustainable way? And the reason we don't have that in social science is because it's hard and it's expensive and it's difficult to get that kind of data. So we continue this process in government of funding things that we don't really know if it works. And that's what the pay for success model tries to short circuit. And my excitement around the pay for success model was that after 25 years of sort of beating my head into outcomes-based budgeting, it's the first time I ever saw a way that through contract, I can link a revenue source to an outcome goal. And I can say this revenue, it's right here, and government, if we don't hit this outcome, you do not have to pay. We have people who are taking the risk up front and testing to make sure that we will hit that outcome. And if we don't hit it, you won't pay. So that first ever social impact bond that I talked to you about, Rikers Island, they didn't hit the outcome. The intervention wasn't working for the young people in Rikers Island that it was intended to work for. And so the New York did not pay. Now, some people would say, well, that's a failure. You know, it was a failure. You had an intervention that didn't work. But I think it was a success because it demonstrated in the model that this is a way that maybe we can get some funding into some of these programs and start really looking at taking that social science research and saying, let's try it a little bit differently. Because obviously, when I have 76 to 80% of the people cycling back through the system time after time, something we're doing within the system isn't working. We need to do something differently. And so that's why I made the transition to the University of Utah, and I am working on testing the viability of this financing tool, and that's what it is, it's a financing tool, to really infuse some money into some of these challenging social areas throughout the United States and see if we can get some different outcomes for the most vulnerable within our communities.
And that was Carrie Nakamura. She's the Government Policy Director of the University of Utah's Sorenson Impact Center. The topic of this panel conversation, recorded earlier this week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, was criminal justice reform for Salt Lake County. The panelists also include Salt Lake County Council members Jenny Wilson and Amy Winder Newton. Here is Council Member Amy Winder Newton.
So I just want to add, you know, it's funny, as we've talked about this, and I don't want to call elected officials sometimes wimps when it comes to this, but sometimes I think it's hard for us to, unless you have data to really back you up, it's hard to be able to turn to a nonprofit or to, you know, part of your constituency and say, we're not going to fund this anymore. It's not a good thing. And so one thing that's helpful for me as an elected official is to have something to back me up. And data and doing things like this is part of that. It's part of giving you something so you can say, you know, hey, I know you don't love this, but it's not working and we've got the data to prove it. So I think it's helpful.
So, you know, Carrie's described, you know, the mission of her program here at the U now, as well as this, and Amy has as well, this pay for success model. But really, our goal in government, I think, is, but we need to focus a little more on this idea that everything we do, we're measuring. I mean, we're really good at projecting. We're really good at saying, you know, hey, I'm one of the fiscal leads at Salt Lake County, and we think that the growth rate on sales tax is going to be, you know, we're going to have a sales tax growth rate at maybe 6% or whatever, and we can project out. And with that, we can make long-term funding decisions on modifying this program or not. But we're not really good a year later going, was it? And what does that mean? And why were we off? And what do we do to account for the gap because we were off? And I think aside from this pay for success model, what it's done in terms of the conversation at Salt Lake County right now has had us look at where and how do we measure everything. One of the concerns I frankly have is that we overdo that. Like, we don't need, we've got a lot of fiscal officials and elected officials at Salt Lake County and budget officials to look at what we do. We don't want to become paralyzed by action because we're stopping to measure. Or I need another 8 FTEs, staff people, to measure this or that. But we do need to incorporate within our systems, top to bottom, a more reflective way of understanding what our, you know, take the goal, next steps, how we achieved or we didn't, and if we didn't achieve, why. So I think that's one of the cultural changes, aside from pay for success, that Amy and I and Council Member Bradley and others will be working on and trying to figure out a way to better define that in the coming years.
And in fairness, that really is the goal of pay for success, is to spur that transformation in government, to spur policymaking to be data-informed, outcome-focused when you do policymaking. That really is at its core, and that's why I said if I talk to you about procurement reform, because I would love for government contracts, when we do it already in construction, we say, you know, we're going to let a contract at government, and here's what we want you to build, and we're going to measure against some parameters, and we're not going to pay you if you don't do it. And so it's really taking that thinking and putting it into the delivery of services for our most vulnerable citizens. To say, shouldn't we at least do that same thing? Shouldn't we demand that this is the outcome we want for those people? We do not want them cycling back in through the system. We do not want the jail to be the state's largest mental health service hospital or provider. We actually want to do things differently for these people who are the most vulnerable among us. And elected officials ought to be, I think, demanding that and saying to program leaders and government staff, we want you to focus on the outcomes and we'll give you budget to deliver these outcomes for us. But to have someone cycle back in and over and over and over again is a failure as a society. I feel a little strongly about that.
Yeah, you do. Well, and it's interesting because not all of our colleagues are necessarily where we are on this concept. I mean, we've had to, you know, kind of help some of them understand our thoughts on this, and even still, I don't know that they're all 100% sold. And some of the worries come in into the process. And so, what if you don't have a strict enough measurement that's really going to give you really what, you know, that outcomes based evidence? Like, what if you don't have that? And so, you know, there's people who have brought up, we've had an early childhood program, an early childhood pay for success program, where we took students who were struggling to meet the kids who were on track to end up in special ed by third grade, which third grade was a measurement for us in projecting how many of them would graduate from high school. If they ended up on the special ed track by third grade, the chances were higher that they wouldn't graduate from high school and that it would cost more. And so as we've gone through that, our first case study showed that 97% of the kids they didn't end up in special ed. They were successful. And some have questioned that and said, well, wait a second here. Is that strict enough? Were we strict enough in the standard that was going to make that decision on if they were successful? Because that's just kind of a really high percentage. And so there's questions along those lines that we're working out. And luckily, we have a great provider here, you know, with the University of Utah, who we have faith in will come through with us on helping us set those expectations and those goals and be able to help us see, yeah, you guys did in fact meet this, or no, this doesn't count, this didn't work. The other thing that's been interesting is to see our providers. We are contracting with some service providers to provide these mental health and substance abuse programs and work with the recidivism piece of our new Pay for Success program. And it's interesting, as we've talked to them, hearing them say, this has forced us to think outside the box. And we've had to come up with new ways and try to think through things differently than we had previously. And they've said, you know, our reputation's on the line here, but we're excited for this new challenge to try to see if we can crack that nut and really get things where they need to be and get this program working and being successful in reducing recidivism. So it's been interesting to see how it's affected even some of these nonprofit organizations.
Well, and just to add to that, I think that anytime you enter the idea of change and innovation in government, somebody's going to say, whoa, right? You have done things a certain way in any division of government for a very long time. It might be that a program director will come to Amy and I and Jim Bradley, who are funders, and say, hey, we want to make a change of hiring a new person because our cases are backlogged. Like, we just need more and more. We need additional hands to kind of get through the work. Well, that's not a change. That's a system demand, right? But to do something fairly different and kind of radical per se or you know, innovative is a big deal because it affects a lot of different, it affects employees, it affects current programs, it affects, so it has been, I think, an exercise to go through where and how are the limits to each of these change and what tolerance do we have as policymakers to enter into a new way.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Question and answer time is coming up. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Earlier this week, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted a forum on Salt Lake County's proposed new approach to reforming its criminal justice system. The so-called pay-for-success model promises to use more data-driven and evidence-based practices to meet the county's goals to reduce offender recidivism, which costs taxpayers a lot of money every year. The panelists include council members Jenny Wilson and Amy Winder Newton, and the government policy director of the University of Utah's Sorenson Impact Center, Carrie Nakamura. The group took questions from the audience.
Yes, my name is George Zinn, and this is something that's been very sensitive to me in that I've been directly involved in the system, unfortunately, for 10 months. And so I can speak as an insider on this, and I can see that there's a lot of things that are not working, okay? Because you need to speak to somebody that's actually been involved in the process and know what's going on. Okay, this is not data and money or numbers. There's people and faces behind this as well. Right. And right now, I don't think the system is working because there's not enough social programs inside the jails to help people. They're bogged down. Right now, I think there's, right off the top of my head, approximately 300 inmates per every officer involved, and that's overtaxing on the system. So they can't take care of it. The system, the jail is strictly punitive and not rehabilitative at this point because it takes months for somebody to get into a program, and when they get out, they don't have the social skills or the training to get the jobs they need. You know, I was fortunate I was originally charged with a felony, which could have given me 25. I could have literally died in prison had this not been changed. So, you know, I feel it was a training process for me. But I think now, you know, with what I went through, that I can speak as somebody, that, you know, that's seen how it's working. You know, I think criminal justice is kind of an oxymoron, you know.
Right.
So, anyway.
The notion of criminal justice, we have the criminal system, and we have the idea of criminal justice reform is that we're going to change something. And what George is describing has been my biggest concern about embracing quote-unquote new programs. And I like to think that I'm innovative and I want to try something new and I'm willing to take risk. But we can't create a diversion when we know there's existing need. And that's been my biggest concern. However, when you look at the enormous cost, what we do need is to test systems to determine where we can have better outcomes. So we can't have, it's a very tricky balance. We need to continue to invest in traditional programs in the jail. We need to embrace the things that are working. We know they're working. And we do have data in a bunch of ways. But we also have to look at more investment in that longer equation from, you know, a charge to the person being released from jail to even reentry into the community and those community-based programs that can help people from coming back. And figure out where we're wasting money. Right. And that's the goal, is to take some of the continuum and better define the challenges along the way so that we can invest more and more and more money in what is working. And there's that tough balance in all of that that I'm very aware
is
of.
Is it okay if I add something? We're kind of putting the...
Asking program leaders and service providers to meet with the Georges of the world and talk to them about what their needs are and couple that with the best social science research that gets to the heart of exactly what you're talking about.
Lousy influence.
I'm Mohammed. I'm not American, I'm Egyptian. I like the idea. I like the idea of pay for success. It's so smart. They usually tell us to use target to be smart, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-framed. So I like the idea of pay for success. I have only one concern or one question. So what I understand that Goldman Sachs or any company will pay for everything, and when it succeeds, and another place like University of Utah will judge and say, okay, this is successful. When it's successful, then the government will pay.
Yes.
So who pays for University of Utah to judge that thing and say it's successful?
The county pays for that. So we have some costs associated with doing these programs as far as getting it set up and paying for the moderator or the
independent evaluator.
Yeah, the evaluator. So.
And where we are now, just to put this all in scale, is our cost to run the jail annually are $89 million. And we have just agreed, and took a lot of debate. I don't know. There are a lot of terms, I guess, that we could use to talk to how we've come to this compromise. But we've agreed to a $11 million three-year program for Pay for Success out of criminal justice funding. So it doesn't, and we're keeping the current jail budgeted as is. As Councilmember Newton said, we have a new funding stream of $9.4 million annually. Our jail was paid for, and we have the jail, and it's in good shape. So we now have continued that revenue stream that creates some new dollars, and it's allowed an opportunity for these discussions. What is the right amount to put into existing programs? What is the right amount to look at innovation and change? And the tolerance level for us on the county council ended up being $11 million for two programs over 3 to 4 years.
And I think Councilwoman Wilson, not Jensen, brought up a great point with the program. The $9.4 million had been used to pay for the jail. So 25 years ago, a slate of elected officials, none of which that are on the council now, made a decision to spend $25 million or $9.4 million a year on a jail mortgage to build jail beds. I think there was unanimity, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, no one wants to take out another mortgage for more jail beds. We want to figure out how can we make 2,200 beds right now be the right number for this community for a lot longer. And the answer to that is to get people to not cycle back in through the system so that even as we have population growth, we still don't have the pressure on us to build more jail beds. And as I look at the landscape nationally in criminal justice reform, what really just delights me is for a decade, Jim and I and our friend here, David Bennett, have been saying we don't need more jail beds. If you build more jail beds, they will become full. That is just the reality. They will become full. We don't need more beds. We need to divert people. We need to quit criminalizing substance abuse and mental disorder. And we need to do things differently, not build more jail beds. And I think you should all be proud that you live in a community that your leadership said that is the case. We are going to take $9.4 million that was paying for a jail mortgage, and we are going to invest in some ideas that the ideas hopefully kick down the road really far the day when we need to build more jail beds in this community.
We're actually looking, as we look towards the future, at a community correction center concept where there's a place that we can have a receiving center, bring inmates who, you know, we can assess and decide, do they need programming? Do they need to go to jail? Where do they need to go? As well as a place where we aren't just letting people out of jail and saying, you know, hey, I know we gave you meds and some mental health treatment here, but see ya, you're on your own. We're actually helping to have people have some follow-up and have a place where they can actually get better and that we can improve the community that way.
One of the challenges in all of this is, we have a Parks and Recreation Department, okay, and they come in annually with a request to expand a park, build a new park, modify a park. That's pretty easy for us to figure out. We can drive by, we can look at, oh, look, the child play equipment looks rusty and dangerous, or, oh, yeah, the idea of a dog park. Well, that can get a lot of public input for sure, but we can make that call. The problem with criminal justice is the complexity of the equation. And George is right. I mean, a child getting education at a young age continues on, has better skills. Jesse Jackson once said, it's better to feed the child than jail the adult. Mm-hmm. So that idea that if we can have better interventions, a healthier family, a healthier structure and community, all of the things from day one, that affects it. But, you know, we end up getting the complexity of dealing with the policies of our district attorney and how and he's a great district attorney, by the way, but how that criminal prosecution affects the bottom line in the end and how we end up investing in nonprofit partnerships and what is the sheriff's role and what is the mayor. I mean, it's a lot of complex inputs in the decision-making process, and I think where we can have collaboration, discussion, and really I think I'm one, along with Councilmember Bradley and Councilwoman Newton, who fought to maintain this $9.4 million revenue stream. I would have loved to give you all and your families back $15 a year, but in reality we need the money so that we can help fix the system. And it was you know, a pretty heated discussion, probably the most complex political challenge I think I've faced in terms of my colleagues and where are we going, because of that diffuse challenge and because of the multiple players that go into the investment of getting this right.
Hi, my name is Christopher Collard. I'm a recent graduate in public policy. And it seems like with the last Pay for Success program with the preschoolers, there'd already been a program. They're just searching for ways to fund it. You know, they tried the legislature wouldn't do it, so they had to kind of sidestep to make this program work. So you guys are kind of taking the opposite approach. It seems like there's a clear money donated for the program, but do you have like specific interventions? You've talked a little bit about how complex the interventions really are, and especially with the. I mean, recidivism was exactly what Rikers Island was supposed to do, and that intervention failed. Do we have an intervention plan that will work, that we have data support?
That's a great question. Yes, the answer is yes. First Step House was procured by the county to be the intervention provider, and the intervention that they are putting in place to deal with the target population, and if I remember, I'm not as close to the mechanics of the target population. I believe these are people who have recidivated through the jail three or more times over a 12-month period. So when they say this is the target population we want to look at, and then they do some other screenings. They do LSI scores so that they can look at the risk and needs of the people within the target population to determine what interventions work best, and they've set an LSI score level, which is a level that doesn't very often get treated very well within the community. So what happens right now in the community with the community treatment programs that we have, and there are many and they are great, but most of them only attack like one aspect of the issue for the individual. And what this program, that First Step House, is working with the social scientists at the University of Utah to help bring together is to address not only the substance abuse issues of the target population, but to also address the criminogenic issues. And
define criminogenic.
That's exactly where I was going. Okay. So the researchers have an 8-point scale that they use, or 8 major criteria that they say these are different criminogenic factors. And if people have, you know, 3 or 4 or more of these criminogenic factors, then this is the kind of intervention that we need. And Dr. Rob Butters at the U, one of his great lines is he said, if we only treat substance abuse and we don't treat those 3 or 4 top criminogenic factors, then what we're doing is creating a sober criminal, because we haven't addressed any of the criminogenic issues that are leading to the criminal behavior. And what we need to do is address those criminogenic issues in concert with the substance abuse issues. And this was an interesting conversation that we had with members of the Salt Lake County Council, because some would say, wow, this intervention that the First Step House is putting together is quite expensive. It's going to cost $23,000 for a 12 to 18 month intervention for this individual. But when you step back and you say, but what we know is that individual would have cycled through the jail at least 3 times within a 12-month period of time, may have experienced homelessness, we can start to track all of the other costs, and it goes far beyond the cost of the intervention. But what we know from social science research is that this intervention, based on the risk and needs assessment for the individual, has a pretty good shot of getting that person and moving them, if not completely out of criminal behavior, of maybe even lessening the criminal involvement. So that maybe we take somebody who was doing person crime and now they do property crime. Still not totally great for the community, but better, right? It's a move in the right direction. And so those are the kinds of things that you look at, and it is bringing it. When I said that Dr. Butters is excited because we're short-circuiting his social science research to policymakers, it is amazing to sit in the county council chambers and listen to these elected officials have this kind of a conversation. I don't know that I've ever heard elected bodies have those conversations before.
And I can promise that this won't be perfect. It won't be. But we'll get a lot out of it and we'll learn a lot. But what excites me is look at the players. It's a government program, but we have the University of Utah, an academic institution, weighing in. We have the First Step House that's a nonprofit provider. And we have Goldman Sachs. I mean, where did that come from, that equation? I can tell you I've worked in government at the federal level, the state level, the local level. This is the first time that I've seen anything that is this really innovative. And I'm more than willing to put up a percentage of, you know, revenues at the county to see where and how we can get that model to work so that we can go beyond this core one example to programs so that we know that, you know, back to George, yeah, we need to make sure the things that are working in the jail are funded. We need to fine-tune, and we need to save some bucks so we can apply them to the right places.
And we do know that if we don't do a different intervention, there's a 76% chance that that person in that target population will cycle back through.
And the good news is, if it doesn't work, we don't pay for it. So it's a good deal for taxpayers.
We're wrapping this up here, but you can find a link to this full discussion on Salt Lake County's proposed Pay for Success program to reform its criminal justice system on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.